You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of July 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, North Korea extends the range of its missiles. Have they overextended everyone else's patience? My guests Isabel Hilton and Samira Shackle will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including, could India become a help to China's alliance with Pakistan rather than a hindrance? Is Emmanuel Macron enjoying his honeymoon period a little too much? And China's proposed traffic-avoiding elevated bus runs out of road. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, and Samira Shackle, freelance journalist contributing to New Statesman, Al Jazeera, Deutsche Welle, and indeed Monocle, among others. Welcome both. We will start tonight with North Korea and the most recent and by far the most ominous of its recent missile tests. North Korea celebrated July 4th with its first successful launch of an intercontinental ballistic missile, the Hwasong-14, the range of which potentially, pending the reliable fitting of a deliverable and functional warhead, puts Alaska within range of a North Korean nuke. Reaction from around the world has been predictably unhappy, and the UN Security Council will meet today. But what can actually be done? Samira, first of all, do we understand, and I'm apologizing in advance for asking you to explain the thinking of Pyongyang on this one, why do they keep doing this? Because there's been a sequence of missile tests this year. Everybody gets angrier and angrier every time as the missiles travel further and further. They're pushing their luck a bit, aren't they?
They are, but I think, you know, it's this sort of saber rattling and escalating tensions and so on is nothing new from North Korea. That's been quite a long-standing policy. They quite enjoy kind of riling things up. I think there's probably a sense of opportunism at the moment of exploiting divisions amongst their opponents. The fact that Donald Trump hasn't been particularly backwards in coming forwards with his suspicions of China, for example, which maybe undermines hopes of meaningful collaboration between the US and China, which would be needed to curb the North Korean threat. There's sort of all sorts of things going on in politics in Northeast Asia with their immediate allies with Korea and Japan. So I think it's maybe a sort of calculated thing that it's a good time to ramp this up, along with the fact that it's a provocative regime that doesn't hold back on escalating said tensions.
Isabel, the one thing that everybody does agree on is that all the options available for dealing with North Korea are terrible, which is probably the reason that nobody has really chosen one of them as yet. But how far are we now from the threshold at which doing something can't possibly be worse than doing nothing?
Well, it is getting a little worrying, and the Americans and the South Koreans had a little missile display of their own early this morning as a reminder to North Korea that they could get hit should things turn nasty, along with the little speech about choosing not to go to war is a choice and it can be changed. I don't think anyone imagines that there is a military solution to this, simply because of the vulnerability of Seoul and South Korea. For North Korean artillery, you don't even need a missile to take out Seoul if you're North Korea. Clearly, the rather rapid advance of North Korean competence in this area is pretty worrying, although I would say that I don't think Alaska's within range of North Korean nukes, because although this is an ICBM, although the missile itself could possibly reach Alaska if it wasn't pointing straight upwards, there are still a number of technical unknowns here. It's not known if it would survive re-entry. It's not known that they can attach a payload, because one of the difficulties of launching a nuclear strike is getting a small enough nuclear payload onto a missile to make it effective, and it's not clear that they can do that. So there is still a margin here. What does North Korea want? It wants an end to the Korean War. Remember, that hasn't ended. We're in an armistice. It wants to sit down with the United States directly, which the United States has never agreed to do. And actually, being provocative has worked for North Korea. You know, if you if you have no cards to play, you know, you play your rather miserable collection to considerable effect. You get attention, you get, in the end, you get something, you get a settlement. So if North Korea were now to say, let's talk about X, Y, and Z, people would heave a sigh of relief and probably talk about it.
Samira, as you pointed out, Donald Trump has made his feelings known. It's quite possible that Kim Jong-un is the only other world leader who sort of operates at more or less his intellectual level where international diplomacy is concerned. I mean, he does, I think genuinely, all jokes aside, he does recognise something of a kindred spirit in somebody who is a provocateur, an attention seeker rather, and, you know, somebody for whom belligerence is their first resort rather than their last. But Trump, aside from all his other bloviating and harumphing, did make the point that trade, or at least as he says, between China and North Korea grew 40% in the first quarter of this year. So does Donald Trump have a point when he suggests that China is perhaps not being the steadfast ally here that it could be if it chose to?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think that there's no question that North Korea and the North Korean regime would really struggle were it not supported in various different ways by China, not least through sort of the oil it imports from China, through money that comes through Chinese banks, various different things like that. So I think that's definitely true. And there's a sort of cycle where when these provocations erupt, where China sort of condemns and then doesn't take much action. So I think that's true. I would sort of question the usefulness maybe of the president of the US pointing that out, and the kinds of negotiation or discussions or whatever, however you want to put it, that would need to take place between, say, the US or the international community more generally in North Korea to meaningfully de-escalate these things, somewhat at odds with Donald Trump's approach, I think. So those sorts of things like attempting to broker an end to the Korean War or agreeing to some sort of diplomatic recognition or sitting down around a table or whatever, the kind of complicated diplomacy that would need to take place doesn't seem to be fitting with Trump's approach thus far.
Isabel, what stops China from, you know, whether in public or in private, putting some sort of ultimatum to North Korea and basically saying, just knock it off? The status quo can be maintained, and I'm sure the rest of the world doesn't especially care if North Korea goes on impressing North Koreans. But what stops China from saying to North Korea, just stop it?
Or else what? That's the problem. I mean, China does not want North Korea to collapse. China could make North Korea collapse, although on its way down, it would do some nasty stuff.
So you know, we have China and North Korea holding guns to each other's heads here.
Indeed we do. And North Korea holding guns to the heads of Japan and South Korea at the same time. So if you were to precipitate the collapse of the North Korean regime, you would be, you know, jumping into some very nasty pond, you know, and you don't really know what's in there. Even if it were to sink down gently, which is unlikely, you then have a failed state, absolutely failed state with a very long border with China. And China, who's going to pick up the mess? Would South Korea then take over North Korea? China doesn't want that because that's an American dependency. China doesn't particularly want to take over North Korea. And I'm sure North Korea doesn't want China to take over North Korea. So one goes, the problem with the North Korean, it is the problem from hell in that there really is not a happy solution. And the closest that we got really was the under Bill Clinton, there was a deal to suspend the nuclear program in return for, you know, energy supplies from the United States. The six-party talks kept things on track for a while. But you know, it's unstable. And I think that until we can get back to that kind of multilateral approach, which includes North Korea, instead of driving it further into a corner, we're going to go on seeing these episodes.
Well, let's move along now to another diplomatic wrangle involving China. It's one which is attracting less notice than the one with North Korea, but it might end up causing more trouble. China's plans for the construction of the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor are receiving predictably poor reviews in India, which is unhappy about the fact that the CPEC, as we're calling it, passes through Pakistan-occupied Kashmir. China and India are also presently at loggerheads over a border dispute on the other side of each country. Samira, first of all, how big a deal is CPEC? I mean, it's a fairly extensive enterprise, isn't it?
Yeah, it's massive. It's a huge, huge program of investment in Pakistan and infrastructure, which is severely lacking at the moment. So it's basically a route mostly by road and rail. It's about 3,000 kilometres through the length of Pakistan. So it goes from Xinjiang province in China, which shares a border with Pakistan, comes all the way down through the length of Pakistan, which is absolutely enormous, going through some quite sketchy areas on the way, down to a warm water port in Gwadar in Balochistan, which then sort of gives China access to shipping routes to all sorts of markets that it would have taken much longer to access without that. So it's big from China's perspective. From Pakistan's perspective, it provides a level of investment that they simply don't have in Pakistan. So building those kinds of roads, railways, there's a whole set of other investments that go along with it, like investing in certain areas and in energy projects and so on. So it's a really big deal. I would say I think that in the latest Indian criticism of it relating to it going through Kashmir is just the latest. I mean, India is very, very, very nervous about this whole project. There's this obvious rivalry between Pakistan and India. There's also sort of perpetual fear of encirclement in South Asian politics. You know, Pakistan doesn't want to be taken over by India. India doesn't want to be taken over by China. India's actually developing its own sort of trade route and going through Afghanistan and to a port just over the border, about 30 kilometres or 80 kilometres away or something from the Pakistani port. So I think this is just the latest in a long line of criticisms, and they're worried about being economically overtaken and also about the potential for China to use that port for naval purposes and not just simply economic.
Isabel, it's probably understandable enough that India is unoverjoyed by this coming together of its two great regional traditional rivals. But China's state news agency did run something suggesting that India could become a partner in the Belt and Road component of the initiative. Now, is that genuine coded outreach, or is this the Chinese Communist Party having one of its little japes?
I think it's having a little giggle. There was a big Belt and Road summit, you may recall, a couple of weeks back in Beijing. Conspicuous by its absence was India. And in addition to the corridor, the one that comes down from Xinjiang to Gwadar, there are another 200 projects in Pakistan. The Dawn newspaper got hold of the Chinese master plan for Pakistan, which is absolutely breathtaking in its scope. And it involves, you know, cyber security, it involves Chinese running television stations, it involves building atomic energy plants. It is absolutely massive. Visa-free entry for Chinese citizens, investment in all manner of business. I mean, it's pretty much an economic takeover.
It has been likened, not altogether fancifully, I don't think, to the Marshall Plan.
Indeed, or the East India Company, as some people in Pakistan likened it
to. You say tomato.
Yes, quite. But anything, you know, India's fought wars with only two countries in its post-independence history, China and Pakistan. So the idea that China will, you know, build up Pakistan economically and strategically is pretty worrying. It's a long-standing Indian complaint that China uses pressure on the India-China border to tie down Indian troops in favour, if you like, of Pakistan, because that relieves pressure on Pakistan.
Their
rivals in Afghanistan. This is a very...
Is that what is now going on in Sikkim, though? The border dispute between India and China in on the other side of the country. Is there a relationship, or is that an entirely separate thing?
That is part of a sort of two-pronged territorial dispute in which involves Arunachal and Sikkim. So you have Arunachal, which China claims as South Tibet, which is occupied by India under Indian control, and you have Sikkim, which India claims, which is under have I got that the wrong way around?
No, I've got the
right way around. These are subject to a certain amount of jockeying always, but I don't think that they're directly connected to this.
Samira, what is China's particular interest in Pakistan? We can see how this works from Pakistan's point of view. As you were saying, it is a colossal investment in infrastructure, which Pakistan obviously needs. But does China just see this as an economic imperative, the road to the warm water port that you mentioned? Or is there an element of strategic jockeying with India involved here as well?
I'm sure that's part of it. And it's also part of a massive program, not just limited to Pakistan, of sort of seeking regional dominance, I think, and investing in lots of different places. And, you know, through that kind of massive infrastructure investment, which there's been quite a lot of rumblings in the Pakistani press recently about the cost of the interest payments, because that's been the sort of exact terms of the deal have been kept very closely guarded. You know, that sort of massive investment allows not just economic involvement, but all sorts of other things. I think Isabel mentioned the East India Company. You know, famously, you know, we hear all this stuff like, you know, the British built railways in India, for instance. But for what purpose? To take resources out? And I think that's that's the suspicion that is all over the place in Pakistan. I was there a couple of times last year, and it's a big topic of conversation. This idea that it's sort of colonization again by stealth. And in Gwadar, I've been there. That there's sort of, it's really striking. I mean, there's a Pakistani flag and an even bigger Chinese flag flying next to it. It's quite striking in a part of the country that's very nationalistic and has its own sort of separatist insurgency and so on. It's very, very striking.
There's an echo there, of course, of China's behaviour in Africa, which yeah. some people in Africa have
exactly.
regarded as colonisation by other means as well. I mean, just finally on this one, Isabel, if India decided it really wanted to sod this thing up, could it?
Well, it can certainly make life difficult, I suppose, or try to make life difficult in Kashmir. Frankly, I think the Baluch will probably make life difficult enough in Kashmir for this corridor. I'm not sure that the Chinese are all that popular, certainly amongst committed Muslims in Pakistan because of their behaviour in Xinjiang. What India might do better to do is to develop or to put some effort into developing its rival corridor, which is a Bangladesh-China-India-Myanmar corridor, which the Chinese have rather cheekily proposed be linked to CPEC. But India's worried about the maritime aspects as well as the land-based aspects. It's worried about the Indian Ocean, which is never, you know, which it regards as, you know, fairly ungoverned territory, but it and that's been fine. But now it's beginning to think, with China's expansion as a maritime power, that it's going to have to worry more actively about the defence, its maritime defence.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Isabel Hilton and Samira Shackle. Coming up next, is President Macron of France getting a bit Louis the 14th?
Monaco has bureaus around the world, in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Hong Kong, our bureau chief is James Chambers.
There's no such thing as an ordinary day in Hong Kong. On any one day, I may be interviewing a city mayor or having coffee with a hotelier or chatting with an interior designer and then trying out the latest bar or restaurant. And mixed in with all of this, there'll be some wacky or outrageous news coming out of China which deserves to be covered on the radio. So it's this variety that I really love about the job.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Isabel Hilton and Samira Shackle. Now, let's look at France, where the far-left leader Jean-Luc Mélenchon does not appear altogether reconciled to his first-round exit in this year's presidential election. He has accused his vanquisher, President Emmanuel Macron, of becoming drunk with power and has called for a nationwide day of protest next week. Although how anyone in France tells which is a nationwide day of protest and which isn't is an interesting question. Samira, a drunk with power, really? Are you getting a drunk with power vibe from President Macron?
No, not really. I mean, it's not necessarily the legislative programme I would have chosen, but he did stand on a platform saying he was going to do this stuff, win the runoff, and then win a majority of seats in order to implement said programme. So I think drunk with power is a bit of an overstatement.
I mean, he could be forgiven, could he not, Isabel, a certain amount of preening, given that literally nobody knew who he was a year ago, and he's now president of France. You can see how that could go to a bloke's head a bit.
Well, not only president of France, but he owns the Congress too. I mean, it's pretty enviable stuff. So yeah, a little bit of preening. I think maybe trying to be De Gaulle is probably pushing it a little bit. For one thing, De Gaulle was very tall. For another, he had spent the war, you know, in kind of active resistance in Britain, trying to, you know, get the country back from the Germans. So there was a bit of a track record there that might have entitled him to a slightly more preening than Macron. Although, you know, it's an impressive achievement, but it's not De Gaulle.
I don't know if he's gone totally tête-moi just yet, has he, Macron? Or do you think he's getting there?
Well, he does seem to think that, you know, as De Gaulle did, that you play the presidency as a remote authority figure. That seems to be the way he's playing it. So, you know, summoning everybody to Versailles and laying it out for them at enormous length, but not being involved in the fray, does seem to be his approach, having concluded that those who tried to get their hands dirty didn't do well.
Samira, Mélenchon's actual issue appears to be Macron's proposed reforms to tax and labour regulations, which Mélenchon thinks are overtly pro-business. In fairness, Mélenchon seems to think everything is overtly pro-business. But aren't reforms like that, especially where France's public sector is concerned, kind of necessary? And this isn't just me sort of still transferring my bitterness about Air France's 100% record of losing my bags every time I've flown with them.
Yeah, it's not great, is it? I think so. I think that one of the things Mélenchon's taking issue with is, for instance, making it easier to hire and fire, sidelining unions and so on. So I think what will be interesting to see, because the opposition is so kind of dysfunctional in France at the moment, you've got the Socialist Party absolutely decimated down to 29 seats or something from nearly 300, and the Republicans consumed by infighting. I don't know if that sounds familiar, but they... I think what will be interesting will be to see if it chimes with public opinion, or if you say, as you say, there's a segment of people who think, well, fair enough, reforms need to happen. And that's perhaps what we'll see about whether this day of protest is effective or not. Because I think what Mélenchon's kind of counting on is the fact that there was a pretty high number of people didn't vote in the general election at all. I think it was over 50%, which was a record number in the French parliamentary elections. And so I think he's counting on those people not really backing Macron's programme of reforms at all. So we'll have to see.
I mean, there is a political tradition, Isabel, of the honeymoon period, the idea that once you've been elected, there's usually a stretch during which, if not everybody absolutely loves you, then everybody's willing to give you a certain amount of benefit of the doubt. Does that still mean anything in these days of a hyper-accelerated, always-on news cycle?
Well, I think France has always, you know, slightly ploughed its own furrow politically. I would bet
that's a tactful way of putting it.
There is a little bit of leeway for Macron for a while. I mean, of course, the touchstone is going to be whether France really wants the reforms it appears to have voted for. I mean, he did have a reform programme. He was elected. He then did get his party, which is called, you know, En Marche happened to be his initials too, which is slightly megalomaniac touch.
Well, but drunk with power.
Drunk with power. But every time anyone has tried public sector reform in France, you know, the nation as one goes on strike. And you know, I don't know if you've been in France on any of those occasions.
I've been tear gassed in Paris. You haven't really done Paris until that's happened.
Absolutely. But you will know that the population, that the general populace who are not on strike have a remarkable sympathy for those who are. It's not
indeed
it's,
so.
It's not as hostile as it is in Britain, you know, post Thatcher. So that's going to be the touchstone. If he can really get those reforms advanced, then he will have done something pretty extraordinary.
Samira, how much is riding on Macron, though, from the perspective of what remains of the European centre-left, if you were? If this doesn't work, it's not good, is it?
Yeah, it was definitely seen here and across Europe as a sort of great victory for centrism, kind of Blairism's back, it's great, that kind of... That kind of feeling, certainly among segments of the Labour Party here, and I'm sure in other parts of Europe as well. So I think I personally would be quite wary about extrapolating the demise of a whole political movement across very varied countries from the success or failure of one party. But inevitably, that's kind of how it's going to be analysed, I think, as we saw from how it was analysed in the election, this idea that moderate centrist politics can win.
OK, well, finally tonight, we will return to China. Listeners may recall seeing a few months back a story about the development of an elevated bus, a sort of moving tunnel with a passenger compartment atop, which would be able to glide above traffic jams. Listeners who gave this more than 10 seconds thought would also have concluded that the thing was obviously mad and unworkable, and perhaps suspected some plan to part fools from the contents of their wallets. Surprise! Beijing's finest are now investigating the possibility that the so-called transit elevated bus was a scam, and at least 30 people have been arrested. I do like this story. It is basically the monorail episode of The Simpsons come to life. Did either of you invest?
No, I held back on investing, but what is extraordinary is how long this thing has been around. You know, we noticed this about 5 years ago because there is a video of this, you know, working, as it were, as the great scheme of the future.
And it's on the internet at must be true.
Precisely. And, you know, they have managed to extract a lot of money from a lot of people by claiming that they had MOUs with various cities. There was even a test last year, which somehow didn't seem to go very well. It is just extraordinary because one look at it, you would know that this wasn't going to work.
I do like the fact they built prototypes, though. They weren't just happy with computer-generated mock-ups. They built the thing.
Yeah, that's what seemed really extraordinary to me, that they actually made it. And it looks quite terrifying, the thing, doesn't it?
It looks absolutely terrifying. And again, you could just
tell... Very unsafe.
Why? And also, it's easy to see why it obviously
wouldn't work. Yeah.
You just need one car out of place.
Yeah. Well, you need one corner. You know,
one corner. Yeah. Had these people seen Chinese traffic? These are not traffic jams in sort of orderly queues with distinct lines between ranks of cars, at least in my recollection of them. I did want to ask you both about, though, because I do love this story because I'm a big fan of human folly, whether either of you have any particular... I'll ask you first, Samir, a favourite grandiose and idiotic urban projects, whether or not they actually happened.
Yeah, well, my favourite is the cable car that goes from Greenwich to the Royal Docks, Victoria, which is basically from nowhere to nowhere. It goes between two conference centres.
And we should stress to non-Londoners, does actually exist.
Yeah, it does exist. It was built with great fanfare. Boris Johnson said it was absolutely necessary and needed or something like that. It was cost £60 million. It was built during the Olympics. It's absurd. I've been on it once just for novelty value. It takes about 5 minutes. It hasn't even got a nice view, so it's not a tourist attraction. It just takes you over some mud flats and warehouses to a conference centre from North Greenwich Tube Station. It's miserable. And there have been various statistics. TfL announced early on that loads of people were using it during the Olympics, but now they've got zero regular Oyster users, despite all sorts of incentives. Like, if you use it more than a few times a week, you get 50% off your Oyster bill and various things, and still no one uses it because it's completely pointless.
Fabulous.
Well, there was the splendid Glasgow motorway, which just stopped in midair. That was a famous landmark for years in Glasgow. And my favourite non-built scheme, I think, is the proposition in Tokyo that they could solve the Tokyo housing problem by building a massive pyramid half the size of Mount Fuji, which on its own would house a million people. They didn't manage to get that one built. But I want to pay tribute to a fine line of Chinese fraudsters. And in particular, this is the moment to remind everyone of the great ant farm scam in Liaoning about 5 years ago, which was another rags to riches. It's a very similar character, poor family, lots of pictures on the wall, endorsements by celebrities and so on. And he persuaded a lot of people to sink their life savings into... essentially buying cardboard boxes which were said to contain ants, and once these ants had done enough breeding, they would be worth half as much again for their medicinal value. I cannot tell you how much of Liaoning province invested in these phantom ant farms. So here's to the Chinese fraudster.
My particular favourite, just to sign us off, and I do recommend people look it up afterwards, King's Cross Airport. That was going to be a thing. Somebody had an idea for, and it was going to be built above on top of King's Cross, and it was going to be this interlocking network of runways in a circle so planes could land. And astonishingly, it was never built. Thank you both very much for joining us, Samira Shackle and Isabel Hilton. That is all for today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Audrey Fiodorenko. Our studio manager was George McDonough. There's music next at 1900. It's The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. I'm back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.